Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello and welcome to the Versus History Podcast. My guest today is Emeritus Professor of American Studies, John Roper, who's here to talk to us about President Trump's presidency, as well as the recent election. Professor, thank you very much for joining us at Versus History. Before we dive into the election, Professor, and what the result might mean, in 2012 you published a rather large encyclopedia of all of the men who had, up until that year, occupied the office of US President. Are there any similarities of conduct or patterns of behavior that you can identify across those presidencies that might be termed presidential?
I think that's a very interesting question, although I'm not sure that it is possible for us to really identify an identical president in terms of conduct behavior. Can we compare, say, George Washington with Chester A. Arthur, or Abraham Lincoln with Millard Fillmore? Indeed, think about Richard Nixon, compare him with Barack Obama in any meaningful sense. However, I think if you consider the era of the so-called modern presidency, say from Franklin Roosevelt onwards, in terms of the politics of the presidency, and particularly since term limits were introduced after FDR, one of the principal objectives when a new president enters the White House is to be re-elected. So we can think of some similarities in the terms of the way in which their presidencies unfold. During the first term, they need to build a solid record of achievement, always aware they can be the victim of events out of their control. For example, the Iran hostage crisis during Jimmy Carter's presidency, or the economic downturn during George Bush's, or indeed, obviously, the pandemic during Trump's. If they do win a second term, then they need to spend their political capital before the inevitable lame duck period comes, as it comes to an end. I just add one more thing, that we might want to look at this from a slightly different angle. Since Franklin Roosevelt's time, the president has become the focus of the nation's political attention. And I think it's possible to identify a set of expectations that many Americans share about those who occupy the White House, how they conduct themselves and their behavior in office. And I think this is best summed up perhaps by the journalist Theodore White, who talked about the crowning myth of the presidency, the myth that the people in their shared wisdom are able to choose the best person to lead them. And he talked about a derivative myth that the presidency, the supreme office, in some ways makes noble any person who holds its responsibility. Now, obviously, for White, it's Richard Nixon's presidency and his conduct that culminated in Watergate and his resignation that shatters those myths. And I'd argue that in many ways, that legacy is one that his successors in the White House have struggled to restore.
So if you're talking about expectations that are placed upon the office of the presidency or the incumbent of the office of the presidency, how do you think President Trump has lived up to or fit himself into or around those expectations?
The answer is he does and he doesn't. I mean, obviously, his objective for the past 4 years has been to secure re-election. And if you try and separate the signal from the noise, what I mean by that, I've taken that really from the statistician Nate Silver, talking about what you have to focus on in terms of the presidency. There's no doubt Trump's presidency has been very noisy and distracts from the signal. A president who delivers a strong economy, who's avoided military confrontation overseas, indeed has brought troops back home, has pursued diplomatic initiatives in areas as diverse as North Korea and the Middle East, might normally expect to have had a good chance at the polls. But weighing on the other side, of course, and I think overwhelming all of this in many ways, is Trump's behavior in office, his failure to reach out beyond his base support, and of course, his failure of leadership during the coronavirus pandemic. And then I think you also have to think about his attempts now, as we speak, to undermine the integrity of the election, his refusal to concede or indeed cooperate in the transition period before his successor takes office. In this, he's showing a complete disregard for conventions and the expected behaviour of presidents, stretching right back to John Adams. John Adams, who in 1800 also lost a controversial re-election, but established an important democratic principle that to accept defeat and the peaceful transference of power between parties after an election. Trump is the only incumbent to dispute an election result. Other controversial elections, Hayes-Tilden in 1876 and Bush-Gore in 2000, were contests in which there was no incumbent running. I guess perhaps the closest example to Trump we have is Richard Nixon, who also rode roughshod over the Constitution before he was forced to resign during the Watergate scandal. And it's interesting, the Nixon Library in California has recently put on a display of correspondence between Nixon and Trump, dating from the 1980s. John Dean, the Watergate whistleblower, says the letters show two authoritarian personalities who would have a natural affinity for each other. But I think there's a crucial difference. If there are signs that Nixon was paranoid, Trump seems to me to be more of a paranoid narcissist, an infinitely more unpredictable personality.
Well, I was actually going to ask you if there was any historical parallel with Trump's behaviour, but you've just answered that. I suppose my next question is, whenever he has been given the opportunity to respond to criticisms of his behaviour, President Trump has often claimed that his conduct is 21st century presidential. What do you think he means by this? And do you think that this is a valid new method of conducting presidential business?
I guess he could be saying, obviously, that his presidency is unique. It's a break from the past. He plays by his own rules without regard or respect for the conventions of the office. I'm not sure he would put it in these terms, but in many ways, we might think of him, therefore, as a postmodern president. Postmodern in the sense that he denies the existence of any ultimate principles, and as we've seen, disparages scientific truths, indeed any kind of truth, except that which he believes himself. And I, for one, would reject that as a valid method of conducting presidential business. I think one of the most damaging aspects of the Trump presidency has been his constant undermining of objective truths, principally through attacks on the media, obviously summed up in his major contribution to the political lexicon, fake news. Another aspect of this is his use of Twitter to denigrate his opponents in language that can most politely be termed unpresidential. And also, if you'll forgive the pun, to constantly trumpet his own achievements. I think the recent election, if it shows one thing, shows that perhaps that's not the best way to conduct presidential business.
So if President Trump is forging a new path, if you like, however positive or negative that might be, if he is unique as a president, by which metric or by what metric can we possibly judge him if the old metrics don't really function as a measurement anymore?
Well, I think we can have some sense of a metric, even though he doesn't fit in to it in many ways. Although one metric we might think about is the ability to be re-elected. That's necessary but not sufficient in terms of a measurement of presidential success, although defining success is equally difficult. Maybe defining success invites us to consider a broader question. Think of for a moment about the presidents most historians agree to have been among the greatest. The four on Mount Rushmore: Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt. And we might add in Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt. What do they have in common? What metric can we apply to them and then think about Trump in these terms? Well, obviously, Washington sets the bar for a successful presidency. He's the first, in many ways, he defines the office through his character. And unlike Trump, at least he knows when to quit. Lincoln, Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, all wartime presidents, steering the nation through existential crises and threats to its survival as a democratic republic. Then you have Jefferson and Theodore Roosevelt at critical times in the 19th, 20th century, defining the extent and potential of the nation domestically. Jefferson through the Louisiana Purchase, Theodore Roosevelt through announcing the emergence of the United States as a world power. So effective leadership, particularly through times of crisis, also the ability to implement a coherent and consistent vision of what the United States can become and what it can achieve, they're the qualities, I think, that separate those six extraordinary presidents from the also-rans, among whom we might now count Donald Trump.
That takes us quite nicely into the next question. In your book, The American Presidents, Heroic Leadership from Kennedy to Clinton, you discuss how JFK's carefully tailored leadership image of, as you say, president as hero, impacted the way successive presidents came to be viewed. So if JFK was the hero and, let's say, LBJ the war casualty, Reagan the star and Clinton the survivor, what are we going to be calling Trump? How are we going to characterize him in the future? How will we characterize him in posterity?
Well, that's another very good question, I think. I've thought about this, and in some ways one has to put away to one side one's own political persuasions to be fairly neutral in terms of the choice of words. But in one word, perhaps insurgent. Another might be fake. Perhaps, though, we should consider him in these terms. The outsider. Someone who had no prior experience of election to a political position, who suddenly catapulted into the most powerful office in the land. And I thought of this term, I thought of that in terms of an article I came across by the political scientist Anthony King in 2002, identifying the traits of a political outsider. He said they sack people on a large scale, not because they're incompetent, but because they disagreed. They're willing to be extraordinarily rude. They have little or no affinity for the people among whom they move or with whom they have to do business. They're liable to ascribe all successes to themselves, all failures to others. Now, Anthony King obviously wasn't thinking of Donald Trump there. The leader he had in mind actually was Margaret Thatcher. And I'll just leave that thought with you, I think. He also identified political outsiders as either social outsiders who have contempt for the political class, psychological outsiders who define themselves in a sphere other than politics, for example, business, or tactical outsiders who seek to achieve certain ends, whether that's wealth, power, the revival of national greatness, whatever. And in order to achieve those ends, they're prepared to flout or ignore convention. Now, Trump seems to me to fit in to all three categories. So in answer to your question, let's just say Donald Trump, outsider.
That sounds like a great ascription. Now, you mentioned your thoughts about the current situation or the standoff between President Trump's camp and President-elect Biden's. Now, this may be a little ahistorical, and I don't know how much of this will be down to the law. Where do you see this standoff going?
Well, I think that ultimately the Constitution has to prevail. And I would anticipate that next January the 20th, we see the swearing-in, the inauguration of President Joe Biden. But what happens in the next couple of months is very unpredictable, as indeed has been a lot of the Trump presidency. At the moment, it seems that the legal challenges will not go anywhere. If you read Trump's Twitter feed, obviously he is adamant that, and he will believe, I think, forever, that he was robbed of this election. This may be posturing, and this may be his attempt to stay relevant, and even, in a sense, to emulate Grover Cleveland and run again in 4 years' time in the hope of recapturing the presidency. But I think ultimately the question here is how the Republican Party deal with a defeated Donald Trump. And I think his conduct now is revealing a lot about his character, perhaps, that we knew before. I think it's very unlikely that he will turn up to the inaugural. I think he may just beat a retreat to his estate in Florida and play a few rounds of golf. But don't think you've learned the last of Donald Trump. He will try and remain in the public eye, I think, in the foreseeable future.
Just a quick follow-up. So you don't think there's any possibility of him somehow retaining his position as president?
I don't think so. I mean, I think where you have an election that has resulted in a majority for the winner, a margin of some 4 or 5 million votes, and where the challenge has to go through the courts. I think Trump's assumption was that if he could get a challenge to the Supreme Court, where of course he's managed to tilt the balance in favor of the conservatives, he might stand a chance. But the point is that the legal challenges just don't stand up. It's the old adage, isn't it? If you don't have the law, just argue the facts, and if you don't have the facts, argue the law. Well, Trump has neither. So I can't see the legal challenges going anywhere. And I think that ultimately and hopefully they will fizzle out prior to Christmas. The results of the election will be validated by the states early in December, and that should be the end of the matter. One final thing, of course, the argument that this election has been in some senses stolen just doesn't stand up. The ballot paper, you will recall, also includes the votes for the Senate. So if the Democrats were so intent in stealing the election from the president, you would have thought they might have got themselves a majority in the Senate as well.
Thanks for that, Professor. Now, I have one final question for you, and it's a question that has, although I understand the historical evolution of the voting system in the United States, it is a question or an issue that I've constantly wondered aloud. For as long as I can remember, there has been a discussion about reforming the Electoral College system, which essentially decides the election. Do you think this is likely or even necessary?
Necessary, yes. Likely, no. I think with the increasing polarization we've seen in American politics, the tendency for presidential elections to be very close, and the fact that the Electoral College can deliver these distorted results, whereby a candidate like Trump 4 years ago, who fails to get a majority of the vote, nevertheless can get a majority in the Electoral College, really does highlight the problems with this kind of system. Why I say it's not likely is, of course, that in order for change to take place, one would have to have a constitutional amendment, which is extremely difficult, or the alternative would be for the states to act in a coordinated way to change the method by which they decide their electors. What I mean by that is that each state legislature would have to pass a law that would bring an element of proportionality into this, such that electors were divided on the basis of a popular vote within each state. Now, you know, that is not likely, particularly, I think, in those states controlled by Republican legislatures, because it is the Republican Party that has benefited recently from the Electoral College, it really would show no sign of changing it. Even the Democrats might not want to change the Electoral College, because there's a tendency to regard the electoral system as flawed when you don't win, but perfectly all right when you do.
Perfect answer. Professor Roper, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the Versus History podcast. Thank you so much for your insight and your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.